your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Before I call our third case for today, I would like to introduce special visitors that we have with us. We have Justice Buttar of the Pakistan Supreme Court with us. If you will rise so we can greet you. We're delighted to have you with us today. Thank you. And we have Dr. Amna Buttar, who is with the University of Wisconsin Medical School, and her husband, David Lawman, and the court knows his mother, Barbara Lawman, and knew his father, mm-hmm. I'm sure. Mm-hmm. So we're delighted to welcome new friends and a relative of mm-hmm. old friends. And then we have Antonio Riley, who is with us today and who knows the court quite well, mm-hmm. the court him. So thank you for bringing your guests today. And they will stay for part of this argument, but not the entire argument. And they do have a summary of the case we are about to hear. And they have met our lawyers who are going to argue this case. I'll now call our third case, 2005 AP81 CR, State of Wisconsin versus Stephen Muckeride. Arguing for the defendant, Mr. Muckeride, is Attorney Mark S. Rosen. Counsel?
May it please the Court, Honorable Justices, esteemed counsel, Mark Rosen appears on behalf of defendant appellant petitioner Stephen P. Muckeride. This Court should reverse the Court of Appeals decision denying the trial, denying the defendant's right to present the other act's evidence presented that he wished to present concerning the victim's father in this matter, who is willing to testify that his son, on prior occasions, had attempted to grab the steering wheel of the car, and on one occasion had done so. It's very interesting to note because the State of Washington, and I applaud trial counsel for finding this, found a case basically essentially exactly on point, which is State versus Young, which was cited in my briefs and cited by the trial court, cited by the trial attorney to the trial court. This was presented also to the Court of Appeals. It's very interesting with Young because Young is basically a case that the State of Washington has essentially the same exact other acts evidence statutes that we do here in Wisconsin. It has the same exact points for the Sullivan number 2 point, or number 1 point, I'm sorry, with modus operandi, proof of identity, absence of mistake or accident, intent, those sorts of ways of getting that sort of evidence in as a reasonable purpose for getting that evidence in. And basically that case basically did a very good analysis of why such evidence should come in, because it was kind of came in that case, and it should come in for this case to prove intent, to prove the identity of who was the one who actually caused the vehicle's accident. It should come in to prove there was an absence of mistake or accident, and it should come in to prove the intent. The intent of the person who was trying to grab the vehicle and the intent of the driver. That's why it should come in on this case, Your Honor, and that's why.
I don't understand your intent argument. I mean, first of all, I don't see how the intent of the passenger has anything to do with the crime of which Mr. Muckeride was convicted, but I don't see how, I didn't think intent had anything to do with that crime either. Do you want to explain to me how you're using that? I'm a little confused.
I think it comes in as intent comes in because it shows that the victim had an intentional interference, and this is what I basically read in Young, and Mr. Setzers, who was the victim in that, one of the victims in that Young case, his intentional interference with the driver's steering was the proximate cause of the accident. So it basically comes in, from what I can read, for the intent for that. But it, to show that it was not an absence of mistake or accident, therefore it was an intentional grabbing of the vehicle, grabbing of the wheel of the car, which caused the accident, proximate cause of the accident.
But even if he'd done it accidentally, if I buy your argument that that's what he did, even if he'd gotten scared or slipped in a seat and grabbed it to keep himself in position, I don't see
Well, I didn't see that.
How that matters to.
Well, that's where the other acts evidence comes in, because.
I understand that, but I'm having trouble understanding it in this case. That's what I'm needing some help with.
Okay. I think it comes in basically to show that the victim did not accidentally slip and try to grab the vehicle.
But would it matter? I mean, if he slipped and tried to grab the wheel and turned it and the car ended up running into the same object it ran into here, I don't see that it matters whether he slipped and did it intentionally. I don't see why there's a difference. I mean, what's the difference?
Well, I think it comes in because in this case it comes in to corroborate the defendant's own testimony at the trial that basically this is what happened.
And that I can understand.
The trial court did allow it. The trial court, basically the second step is to show the relevance of these sorts of other acts evidence. And clearly it becomes relevance because the trial court said, defendant, you can testify to that. We're not going to keep that out. You can testify. And furthermore, Mr. Defendant, Mr. Muckerheide, we will allow you the jury instruction that you seek concerning the intervening cause terminating his responsibility.
Now, they did allow that. What you're saying, they did allow him to testify. They did allow the jury instruction.
Yes, they did. And they did allow the jury instruction that the defendant requested, saying that if the jury felt that this terminated his responsibility, that therefore he would be, not responsible, not liable. So therefore, it clearly was relevant, I think, and it clearly comes in under this, because of the Sullivan analysis, you have the first, it comes in for a rational purpose or a legitimate purpose, I think is the word of Sullivan, which is the absence of mistake or accident, identity of the person. This is all language that Young uses, which is basically our same identical language here in the state of Wisconsin. And this is a case, once again, I could not find a single case in Wisconsin that is so exactly on point concerning this sort of fact situation as Young.
But he wanted to use it here for motive or intent. That's why you brought up intent. And
He also wanted to use it, Your Honor, for identity, as to the identity of the person that caused the accident. You have the modus operandi, which under State versus Hammer is legitimate use of reason to get the sort of evidence in, because it goes to showing identity. The modus operandi of the person driving the passenger, his way he drives.
Justice
Wilkoff.
I'm just asking, this was your client had a blood alcohol of 0.179. Mr. Ron had a blood alcohol, I believe, of 0.17, I mean the deceased. They both had cocaine in their bloodstream. Do you think that made, or should it make, any difference at all on whether or not the Sullivan analysis should be used, whether the fact that you had a person who was legally, there was no argument, intoxicated at the time?
Well, I think it becomes irrelevant, and I think, once again, the trial court felt it was relevant. They allowed the testimony. They allowed the jury instruction. It becomes relevant because it's not the drinking that's at issue here. It's what caused the accident, whether or not it was the drinking or whether or not it was, in fact, the victim's grabbing the steering wheel and jarring it, which she had done on at least one prior occasion and had tried to do so previously, is what caused the accident. And that's clearly where that jury instruction comes in, which basically terminates the responsibility of the driver if there's the intervening cause. So I think the alcohol issue is why it became the felony level at which it became. And the state's theory was that was the proximate cause of the accident, while the defendant's theory was that, no, even though I was drunk, the victim grabbing the wheel, jarring it, causing me to crash into that construction area is what caused the accident. And clearly, once again, I think, given the fact that the trial court allowed that testimony by the defendant and allowed the jury instruction, I think, therefore, it becomes relevant to decide what, if any, was the proximate cause of the accident. So I think it does make a difference, not in the fact that he was driving. He got on the – my recollection is the defendant got on the stand and testified that both he and the victim had been drinking all day. But if he had just been stopped for an OWI, I think it wouldn't be relevant. But I think given the fact as to what caused the specific accident that happened, which caused the death of the young man, I think then it does become clearly relevant, and I think that's why the other acts evidence comes in to basically corroborate and show that this was not the defendant's fault.
As I understand the other acts evidence,
The prohibited other acts evidence is what we call propensity evidence. That is evidence that indicates that the person acted in conformity with the past acts, and that's prohibited. Is that your understanding of 904.04 sub 2?
Well, that's my understanding of why it's not why it's prohibited. If it is propensity evidence, it's character, and that's what the trial court and the court of appeals found. However, it's our position that it wasn't character evidence.
I want to explore that with regard to two things. You list a number of reasons of purpose why this is available to show intent and motive and identity and control and absence of mistake and MO and modus operandi and plan and identity. Those are all the different things you've argued that it's the purpose for. I just want to focus on two because I can't handle all everyone else, and I'll let Justice Prosser maybe handle the rest. I want to handle MO, modus operandi, and identity. Now, what does modus operandi mean?
It's a method of operation. Under State versus Hammer, which this court ruled in 2000, it defined modus operandi as mode of operation.
Isn't that that's what I think of. That's what I watch on TV, and they say, what's their MO? You know, how did they act in the past to indicate how they're acting now? Isn't that propensity evidence?
Well, State versus Hammer basically indicated that modus operandi, or method of operation, is one of the factors that tends to establish identity. And that's what this court said back in 2000. So therefore, it becomes relevant for the purposes of proving the identity, which statutorily is a legitimate purpose and which Sullivan has said so.
I've looked at a couple of treatises. Sullivan cites Blinka on evidence and then Wright and Graham on their federal practice and federal evidence treatise and Jones on evidence. And there seems to be, and I'm looking now at Jones, real hesitancy about identity. Jones is giving an example in the treatise on evidence, civil and criminal, 7th edition. He gives the example of in a trial for selling cocaine to an undercover officer. And they bring in other acts evidence that the defendant three times before sold cocaine. And Jones says, of course, that he sold drugs in the past increases the likelihood that he sold this time, too. But this use of other acts evidence to prove identity should not be permitted because its relevance is based exclusively on the propensity inference. Evidence should be admitted to prove identity only if its relevance on that issue is independent of and in spite of the propensity inference. Do you agree or disagree with Jones?
Well, I think you have to look on that as a fact-by-fact situation. Just the sheer prior dealing of drugs is propensity. But in this case, if you're using it to prove the similarity, which clearly what Sullivan says is one of the factors to allow a legitimate purpose as opposed to propensity, the identity, statutorily, the legislature said in a 904 the statute that identity, a legitimate purpose, is to prove identity, to prove the similarity. So if, maybe in that situation, if Jones had previously done something very similar to this situation, that similarity, then you could say it comes in as a legitimate purpose. But just the sheer blanket, oh, he dealt drugs before in the past, that becomes propensity. I think where we get to here is you have the similarity of the exact same sort of fact circumstance that happened before to the victim's father that comes in here at this time in the same situation, same circumstances, and that's what Young said, is basically it wasn't propensity. I think that's where the habit argument came in, which I rejected, which comes in, is basically you've got the Young basically saying it shows the identity because it's the same exact thing he did. It's a similarity.
Young discussed propensity or acting in conformity therewith?
I think they had something about talking about propensity, but in terms of the habit argument.
I didn't see it, but I may have overlooked it. So I'm asking you if you know.
I thought there was an argument there that it had to do. Maybe I was mistaken, but I thought there was an argument there about the habit and that the court rejected a habit argument, saying because of it was propensity. That's my recollection. They talk about character evidence before they get into the legitimate purpose under the other act statute. The court in Young rejected any sort of a habit argument because they did say it was propensity. It's not similarity, just a character. But then they get into this whole issue of the 904 other act statute, and that's when they came and saying it is relevant for this purpose as an identity to prove the intent, who caused the accident, that sort of thing. And then that's where they get into the modus operandi, which is what Hammer said is legitimate in the state of Wisconsin. So we can't mix it up. That's why I think I did not go with the habit, because I think that that is a propensity argument, but I did go with the other acts, because I think clearly under Young, they do distinguish the two, and I think that when you look at the distinction, I think it does come in as an other acts evidence argument, but it doesn't come in as habit. So I think that when you look at that, I think it does come in for legitimate purposes. It does meet the threefold test under Sullivan. It does come in for a legitimate purpose, which is identity, the modus operandi, which Hammer said is used to prove identity, absence of mistake or accident, intent, who did it, that sort of thing.
Counsel, if I could, I'd like you to really focus your argument, because when you use the shotgun approach by arguing every aspect of the statute, you lose me, and that's because each of those exceptions under 90404 sub 2 have criteria for admissibility to them. So if you could really focus, I understand your argument regarding identity, and if you could focus in why that would come in as identity evidence under the case law, under Scheidel and Rushing and some of the other cases, or if you're going to go under some of the other prongs, why it would come in under one of those prongs. But if you just lump it together and say, well, it fits under the statute, I don't know what that means.
And I appreciate that, Your Honor. I'm just looking at it because I think there are multiple theories and multiple legitimate purposes to allow this evidence in. I think the clear one that comes in, the most hit you in the head one, is clearly the identity one, which I think is the one that Young really focused on, as well as the one that I think is the who did it.
And the reason I want to focus you is because if you look at Young, and what you have there, you have numerous acts, as I understood the Washington opinion, numerous acts of reaching over and grabbing. Whereas I understand the facts of this case, you have one. And if you look at the language of Scheidel, it must show up such a concurrence of common features and so many points of similarity between the other acts, plural, the present act, that they constitute such as an imprint. I mean, I'm looking for the type of thing that would, why this really goes to identity. I don't see intent, because I don't see where intent is at issue here, or why it's relevant, and some of the other issues. If you're going to focus on identity, why does one reach a year prior establish that the identity of the person operating or the vehicle to cause the accident? Maybe I'm missing something. I want to follow your argument. I want to understand why it all links together. We don't have the four or five acts that you had in the Washington case. You got the one. So draw the link for me.
I think it was one, Mr. Brown, the father was willing to testify as one act of actually grabbing, and I think three or four acts where he attempted to grab. And I think it comes in because it basically corroborates the defendant's testimony, which is that the victim did this, and that's where you have the identity, because it's another act. Clearly, I don't think the numbers, because you can have one prior act coming in as another act. I think there's case law to that clear effect. I think I remember reading a case law where if one prior, I think it was Gray, which said one, you have a prior act from 4 years ago, one prior faking of a hydrocortisone bottle, the prescription drugs can come in this time basically to prove he did it on this case. I don't think you need a multiple amount. I think the issue that Sullivan basically focuses on isn't the number of prior events, it's the similarity. Because, for example, child sexual assault cases, you don't have a number of prior child sexual. You have basically somebody who may have, a few years ago or a year before, may have sexually molested another child. So you have that one instant. But it clearly comes in because it shows his identity. It shows his intent. It shows his motive. You don't need a number. It's basically, from my understanding of the law, is it's the similarity, not the number of prior events. There is no bright line between numbers saying four comes in but one doesn't. It's equationally how similar was the prior intent. Because in this case, it's clearly shown to corroborate Mr. Makarahiti's testimony that that's exactly what happened on this occasion. It happened exactly the same way before.
Mr. Rosen, most of the time that we hear arguments about the admissibility of other acts evidence, the state has offered evidence. It's been accepted against the defendant. Here you have a situation where the defendant wishes to offer other acts evidence. Are the standards for the admissibility of evidence exactly the same in both situations?
I think you still have to look under the Sullivan theory of analysis. I think Sullivan did a very good layout as to how it comes in and the criteria for coming in. Clearly, I think the state isn't even disputing that it can come in by the victim. The defendant can present this, and I think there's some case law that was presented in my my brief that shows that you a third party acts can come in, where a victim's acts can come in. The defendant can present that to show the other acts evidence and to get that in. So it can come in. If there's a different standard, I'm not really sure if there's a different standard. It might go to the issue of the prejudice, because I think when defendants have a right to present a defense and a right to defend themselves, and I think that when you do that, you have to look at the prejudice.
You have until the red light goes on, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We have Mr. Braun. I understand that you contend that he was nervous, that a nervous character of nervousness?
I think he had a tendency to possibly react in situations that he felt was dangerous to him by trying to grab the wheel or grabbing the wheel.
Was that a character trait?
I don't know, Your Honor. All I know is that it was simply something that he did, which was something that is in conformity with what he did now as far as to prove the other. It was an other act evidence to prove that he did.
I look at you, Mr. Rosen, and I see you talk a lot with your hands. Is that a character trait?
It could very well be, but I think the character per se is not inadmissible. I think if it comes in under the Sullivan standard, meets the three prongs of Sullivan, it can come in as an other act. It's not the character, it's the act that comes in under Sullivan. It's what he did on a prior occasion and how that prior act and how similar it is and whether or not it meets the three prongs of Sullivan that is the defining issue here. And I think that
What I'm getting at is that under 904.04.1b, character of victim, when offered by the accused, sometimes the evidence of a pertinent trait of character of the victim of a crime offered by the accused can come in. That's not under sub 2, other crimes, wrongs, or acts.
Well, I appreciate that, finding that. That's another reason why it should come in, Your Honor. I just went under the other acts theory based upon what trial counsel presented at the trial and what was argued with respect to Young. But clearly, I think that it could come in under that theory there to prove that the character was that, as you've indicated, he was a nervous type who had a tendency to grab the steering wheel and did it before. And that's another preview, because then you have Mr. Braun coming in to testify to that again.
Sure, the Assistant Attorney General will explain why that can't happen. But
I'm here under the 90404 sub 2, which is basically the other acts under Sullivan. So I'm just going to argue that basically that it isn't character, it's the act that he did, the similarity of the act that he did, and how it relates to what happened on this occasion. is basically does come in and is solvent.
Okay. Now, isn't it true that the defendant really didn't talk about this grabbing of the wheel early on?
Well, maybe he did or didn't. It's something that goes to his credibility. I don't know why he did or didn't. I can't say that. All I know is that the trial court allowed him to testify to that at trial, allowed the jury instruction to come in, and basically did not keep that the father's evidence out under any sort of under any sort of credibility issue that, well, he didn't present this before. They simply said, we don't think it's other acts evidence. So they never really got into it. It's something that should be presented at trial, and maybe that's another reason why he should get a new trial, because he didn't have a right to present a full and fair defense that would affect his credibility, that would help bolster his credibility as to what he basically said on the stand, that yes, it happened. So then you have the father coming in, so to help bolster his credibility, not just as another act, but basically simply to bolster his credibility. Well, you didn't say this before. Well, here's proof it happened, and here's corroboration. So I think it comes in that way, too. It comes in as to present basically a full and fair picture of what happened on that night and to help bolster his credibility.
Were there witnesses to this offense?
I think what there was, Your Honor, my recollection from what I read was that there was somebody who saw the car going, but it was dark out, but they didn't see the accident itself. They came upon later, and they said they saw the car coming down, but it was very dark out, and I think there was some issues about what sort of a clear view they had. One person testified at a trial, and I think it was an elderly person. I can't really remember, but that's all there was. This occurred at night, from my recollection, and it wasn't very well lit.
Someone testify the car was going too fast?
I think they may have been testifying to that, but I don't remember them having a clock or having a speedometer. It just basically came out of the blue.
Did that person who testified that the car was going too fast testify that the car swerved suddenly?
I don't recall that testimony. I don't recall that, but I think what else there was testimony is I don't recall that person testifying that they saw the actual accident. I could be wrong, but I don't think they saw the car going past, and then all of a sudden it went out of sight, and then they came upon the accident. That's what my recollection is. So they didn't get a full, fair view of the whole scene. They can't basically testify as to what happened as far as how it hit the construction site. So I think you have to look at it that way. And I think basically when you look at it that way, it's the defendant's testimony as to what happened, and basically you have, I don't know what there was.
Does the harmless error apply here?
Pardon me, I'm done out of time, Your Honor.
I know. Does the doctrine of harmless error apply in this fact situation?
I'm not sure I understand that, Your Honor.
Well, let's suppose you're correct, and the trial court committed error in refusing to let you put in this evidence. All errors don't reverse a conviction. The error has to be prejudicial error.
Right.
And doesn't the concept that the harmless error doctrine apply to this case?
I don't think so, because clearly the trial court felt that there was an issue there, that it was a question of, because they allowed the defendant to testify and they allowed the jury instruction to come in. It's a question of what happened. I mean, if it's not harmless error, because if it was caused by the victim grabbing the steering wheel and causing the accident as opposed to alcohol, then clearly it's not harmless. And I think that that's where it becomes clearly non-harmless error. Chief, thank you.
Chief, if I might.
Justice Butler.
What is the standard of review in this case?
I think you basically look at...
Is this discretionary?
I think it is discretionary and abuse of discretion. I'm not really quite up on that. I think it's basically an abuse of discretion, but I also think it's basically what should the law be? Thank you.
Chief, just... For clarification,
Justice Bradley.
I understood the State's brief to encompass constitutional challenge argument. Are you making a constitutional challenge in this case?
No, I'm simply making an argument that the trial court and the Court of Appeals made a mistake in not allowing the other act's evidence, that it does meet the standards of admissibility under State v. Sullivan, and because it comes in for a legitimate purpose, and basically that's where you get State v. Young, and I think that's what you look at, is basically Did the trial court make, does this meet the standards of State versus Young, of State versus Sullivan as a legitimate or other acts evidence, or doesn't it?
And you're not advancing the argument that it violates your client's constitutional right to present a defense?
I'm not going to waive that argument, Your Honor. I think that my client does have a right to present a defense and that my client does have a right to present that sort of issue. I think I can clearly understand that there's a it still has to come in. It still has to be relevant. It still has to be something that's relevant. I think my client doesn't have the right to present just anything out of the blue, but I think if it is relevant, he has a right to present a defense, and he does have a right to present relevant defense evidence and defense testimony, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Assistant Attorney General Sally Wellman, arguing for the State of Wisconsin.
May it please the Court, Assistant Attorney General Sally Wellman representing the State in this case. If I can just get to some of the questions that you were asking, I'm assuming that you would like to revisit some of those issues, and if I miss any, I'm sure you'll let me know. I'd like to talk a little bit about Young first, because while it certainly appears to be very similar to our case in terms of similar evidence being offered, a similar defense, the defendant was convicted of their Washington State's equivalent of homicide by intoxicated use of a vehicle, and he claimed that a passenger grabbed the steering wheel, and that's what caused the accident instead of him driving under the influence. And so it certainly, you know, is pertinent to talk about. I don't understand the Young decision when it says that the evidence comes in for basically the same purposes that Mr. Muckerhyde wants to bring it in. Because although they have an other act statute that seems to be comparable to ours, they never talk in that decision about how you get past the propensity bar using the evidence for those purposes in that case. They talk a little bit, and they don't number their paragraphs, so it's not as convenient, but if at page 1174 of the Pacific Second site, so it would be 739 Pacific Second, 1174, there's a paragraph that says, generally a person's prior conduct is not admissible for the purpose of proving he acted in conformity therewith. And there they're talking about 404A, which seems to be similar to our 404A. And then they talk about how habit, you can use habit for propensity for that very thing to say, well, he always does this and they're in this situation, therefore it's likely he did it again. But they said Mr. Young didn't have enough instances to be habit. But then when they got to our equivalent of 404B2, they didn't talk about propensity anymore. They just accepted that it's relevant to show, you know, identity and that he caused the accident instead. But it's only relevant to prove those if you first make the inference. It's likely he did it, what Mr. Muckerhyde testified he did, because he's done it before. And that's exactly what's prohibited. I also, I didn't find any subsequent cases to Young anywhere. So, you know, I don't know how it's been interpreted by the Washington courts. I also find it puzzling, very puzzling, when the court gets to the balancing test, which we would do in the third prong of Sullivan. And this is on page 1175 of the Pacific Second decision. They're talking about their ER 403, which would be our 90403, weighing the probative value and the prejudice. And then it says, here, evidence of Mr. Setzer's conduct, and that was the passenger in the Young case, here, evidence of Mr. Setzer's conduct on the night of the accident was highly probative and crucial to Mr. Young's theory of defense that it was Mr. Setzer and not he that caused the accident. But the other acts evidence didn't go to his conduct on the night of the fatal accident. I mean, Mr. Young testified to that, just as Mr. Muckerhide did here. What was the question was whether prior instances on other occasions where Mr. Setzer had apparently grabbed the steering wheel with other drivers should come in. So, I mean, I think that Washington or Young is not persuasive because they never explain, as we would expect our courts to, how this evidence comes in for something other than propensity. I mean, it's one thing to label it, well, identity, but that would be like the state here. Suppose in this situation, instead of this fact situation, we had the accident and both the driver and the passenger were found outside the car, after, and they're both still alive afterwards, and they're both saying the other person was driving. Well, just to say, well, the state, I'm not saying they never would, because sometimes they try to get an evidence they shouldn't, but we certainly shouldn't be allowed to present evidence of Mr. Muckerhide's past driving record, just to say it goes to identity to show he was the driver.
Well, let me just explore that. There are a number of cases where the state brings in evidence to show identity, like, I mean, the classic one, at least in our jurisdiction, is Witte, which was the black and white rabbit, which shows, of course, the person's propensity towards liking little children sexually. A bond, it was also to identify him as the culprit in that particular case because he used, somebody used a black and white rabbit, and therefore he now uses a black and white, or this guy uses a black and white rabbit. So you make the assumption that they're the one and the same person. I mean, that's the identity. And you got cases that are very much further away than that, where the guy commits a rape in a garage and uses his jacket as sort of a mattress. And you may have had one or two such occasions. It may not have been precisely the same jacket or a garage, et cetera, but that we let that evidence in to show identity. Now, let's just suppose that the facts in this case were that the victim here survives and Mr. Muckerhide died, and that the state's position is that although the victim, in this case, was on the passenger side of the car, seated there, you are bringing a lawsuit against him for homicide and drunk driving. And you want to show that he, on at least one occasion, which his own father is going to testify to, grabs the wheel. And one time he was successful, other times he just moves towards it. I mean, what you got is a front seat driver in the passenger's car, right? I mean, instead of just yakking, watch out, do this, do that, the guy is going to drive from the passenger side and grab the wheel. And wouldn't the state be allowed to bring in that kind of evidence to show he was really the driver? That is, he's the one that caused this incident?
I don't see how we would be in this incident. It's possible that if we had a reckless element to him doing that, it might come in for that. But just purely to show it's more likely he was the one who was driving because he did this before. I don't see why it would come in.
How would you bring it in as reckless?
If we could show that on the prior occasion he had done it, and so he should know that it could cause the kind of harm that ultimately resulted. I'm thinking there's a civil case where the person's prior driving record came in not to prove that reckless driving in a particular case, but damages or punitive damages because it went to her knowledge of the harm. So I'm thinking it's sort of along that line. But no, just to prove that it's more likely that he did it, I would say it shouldn't come in for that purpose. And in this case, it really isn't.
What about motive? His motive is safe driving.
Well, motive isn't any element of the defense here or the crime that, you know, we've posited that Mr. Braun might have committed.
That's right. But motive generally isn't an element in a crime. Motive is generally not an element. Intent may be, but motive isn't. And yet, I think you can find many cases that say, well, his motive was to get money. That's why he robbed the bank.
Sure, because it's relevant to an issue in the case. But here, motive, whether he did it, assuming he did it, whether he did it accidentally or intentionally, or whether he was hoping he would get just a little injury and then he could collect some money from somebody, that doesn't matter to Mr. Muckerhide's defense. It's not identity in the sense that somebody grabbed the wheel and caused the accident, and we don't know which passenger it was. It isn't a question of who grabbed the wheel. It's whether Mr. Braun did or not. So that's why it's different from Scheidel and the other cases. I can't remember if there was another defense case where it was identity. Here, if someone grabbed the wheel and caused the accident and grabbed it while Mr. Muckerhide was driving, it was Mr. Braun. So it's not an identity of who did it. It's whether he did it.
One of the problems I have is if I see, a group of people forming and getting in a parade, it sounds like that maybe, or it looks like maybe it's a trend. It's, people are lining up behind one another. And I found this case from the appellate division in New York, State versus Crombleholm. And I don't have that in front of me right now. But it was a charge of reckless driving and manslaughter, and the issue was, the facts were that there were a couple of attempts, and more than attempts, I think, a couple of times earlier that the defendant had grabbed the steering wheel, that the passenger had grabbed the steering wheel. And lo and behold, that case, and I read it online, that case said, oh, yeah, it goes to identity. And I kind of swallowed it, surprised me, and I have the case, I'm having it brought now. Thank you. Because I wasn't very impressed with the Young case. I didn't think it was well written. It didn't even mention to act in conformity therewith. When you look at the history of the case, it's been kind of rained on, So what do I do? And I see a couple of cases lining up and saying it's identity when you have someone grabbing the wheel. In the New York case, as I said, it was several times as opposed to this one time a year ago, 4 o'clock in the afternoon while driving with his father. And I don't know if it was down Wisconsin Avenue or where it was. It was someplace in Milwaukee. What should I make of that? It's a hard question because you haven't seen the case.
I haven't seen the case. I'm not familiar with it. And, I'd need to know whether they explain any better than Young does, which is not well at all, why it goes to identity in that case. And I think, to the extent that they're relying on you, how often did it happen before and is it similar? We don't get there until we get through the first prong of Sullivan, which is it admissible for a proper purpose? Now, I suppose in theory, a court could be saying, well, if you have several instances, two or three with different drivers, that's getting you close enough to have it. Or it's somewhere between other acts for propensity, which we don't allow, and habit, but because it's the defendant offering it, if it's close enough to have it, we'll let it in. But that's certainly not how the Young court explained it, and I'm sensing that perhaps the New York case didn't really explain it either. I have to say, I assume that we would be talking mostly this afternoon about whether Mr. Muckerhide had a constitutional right to present this evidence, even if it didn't come in under the Sullivan analysis. And, I could, in theory, if a court were to, a court in another state were to say, well, yeah, this doesn't come in because it's really just propensity evidence and it doesn't really fit what we normally see as habit, but we're going to do a constitutional analysis, at least that would be a reason for saying it comes in. Not that I agree by any means if he does have a constitutional right to present it. But to just say, well, it comes in because it corroborates his story and it goes to identity of who was driving him or the defendant, That doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, but ordinarily, you don't have the right to introduce all kinds of evidence. You generally have a right to introduce evidence that fits under the rules of evidence. Every once in a while, the rule may be held invalid because it denies you a right to defense, such as the rape shield law under certain circumstances. But what's your argument here where there's a specific rule about other acts, evidence or habit evidence or character evidence, and if you don't fit within it, how can you argue that you've got a constitutional right to present it?
Well, it seems to me that if a person were going to argue that, you would have to do something similar to what you did in the rape shield law, although it isn't really a neat fit, because in the rape shield law, he absolutely, Polizzano, was not allowed to present that evidence under the rape shield law. And so you could have just said, well, that's the end of it. There's a valid reason for not letting other acts evidence of the sexual assault victim in, and we're done. But instead, you looked at, well, what was the importance in that particular case, which in that case was a child victim who was able to describe a very detailed and with a lot of sexual knowledge the acts that he claimed the defendant perpetrated on him. And there was the concern that, regardless of what the prosecutor argued to the jury, that the jury, just in common sense, would draw the inference, well, it must have happened, or how would a 10-year-old boy even be able to describe those things? 10-year-old boys or 5-year-old boys, whatever, I think he was about 6, don't even know about, you know, fellatio and anal penetration and those kinds of things. And, you know, that's a reasonable common sense inference. And the only way the defendant in that case could rebut that would be to present evidence that he knew how to describe it because it had happened, but it had happened before and someone else did it, not the defendant. And so, you know, you set forth the Polizzano test to get it in. Now, in St. George, then, you sort of morphed, is the word I use, the Polizzano test to and went through analysis of whether expert testimony should come in. That was, again, being offered to rebut the state's evidence. There, the state had presented expert evidence that, the little girl victim in that case had recanted, and the state had presented an expert who talked about some percentage of recantations in which the recantation is then recanted. And the person who did the interview with the child had testified, the social worker, a caseworker person, that she or he used an interview technique, a cognitive, I forget the name of it, technique that is known to produce reliable information. And the defendant wanted to put in expert testimony of his own that, one, you can't really tell anything from statistics on recantation about the specific child's recantation, whether it's likely to be true or not, because statistics don't give you a basis to draw an inference in a particular case, and that there were problems with the interview technique used, and that just because it's been labeled to produce reliable results, it isn't necessarily reliable, and point out the faults in it. And this Court said, under those circumstances, the defendant had a constitutional right to present that evidence, even though this Court wouldn't necessarily say it was an abuse of discretion for the trial court to keep it out. The problem I have are trying to create a test where we would take one of those and sort of look at it here. In St. George, the first question, in Polizzano, the first question is, did the prior act clearly occur, and is it similar to the charged act? Because if there's no real evidence that ever occurred, of course, it's not very relevant, and if it's not similar, it doesn't provide the base of knowledge that we're talking about. In St. George, you phrase the first question as, well, does the evidence come in under the rule of evidence on expert testimony? And it seems to me that that doesn't really, you weren't doing the same thing in Polizzano, because in Polizzano, it clearly didn't come in under the rape shield law. And so under the rape shield law, you don't get to do any analysis of relevancy or probative value. It's just out. In St. George, you were doing basically the same analysis sort of twice, because you look at admissibility on the admissibility factors on discretion, and then you look at similar things. So I guess if I were writing it as an argument as to why there would be a constitutional right, I might want to not use quite the test you used in St. George. All that having been said, the important parts, I think, are to look at the necessity. You know, is it really relevant for what is being offered to prove? Is that necessary to the defendant's case? And in some other decisions, the U.S. Supreme Court and this Court has used, you know, critical or crucial to prove his defense. And here, the thing that's a little different here, too, is in this case, I'm not hearing the defendant say, well, it does, okay, we admit propensity is bad. You can't bring it in just to prove propensity, but it's being offered to prove something else. He's really, I think, is saying, yes, it's being offered to prove he did it before. That makes it more likely he did it this time. And because that's my defense in a criminal case, I have a right to bring this in. And if we're going to go in that direction, it seems to me there has to be some limits and some way to tell future courts, trial courts and court of appeals, well, how do you determine when it is and when it isn't? I mean, it's not truly his defense in the sense that his defense is what he testified to. I mean, he gave his whole defense from the witness stand. This is what happened. This is what Mr. Braun did. He wants to corroborate that with this other act evidence. If you just say, well, because that's the only way he can corroborate it, because there are only two people there and one of them is dead, we have to let it in, then it seems to me it would be very hard the next time to say, well, if you have a defendant who has the same story, only two people there, the victim is dead, the passenger is dead, the defendant testifies, I'm driving, he grabbed the wheel, that's what caused the accident, I need something to corroborate my defense or else the jury is just going to reject it as self-serving. So I want to bring in an expert. I want to bring in a retired trial judge who says, look, I sat on the bench for 40 years. I heard people talk to me all the time. I made decisions about who's telling the truth and who isn't. I'm an expert at this, and I believe he's telling the truth. We normally wouldn't let that in for any party in a civil or a criminal case. So it can't be enough to just say, well, because he's a defendant, we have to let it in because he needs to corroborate his story.
Ms. Wellman, what do you think the defendant has to establish in order to present that which is necessary to get in identity evidence under the Sullivan test?
Well, I think first you'd have to have identity in the true sense, which is that we don't know which person did this, which I don't think we really have here. But assuming that we did, so say, you know, assuming that you really have an identity issue here, I think you go back and look at Shadle and look at the similarities between the prior act and this act. And if we get that far in this case, I don't think we have sufficient similarities, in part because, you know, the offer of proof was pretty meager in this case. And in particular, from the trial stance point of view, I mean, now reviewing it as the Court of Appeals and Supreme Court, we have the defendant's whole testimony, and he gave a lot of detail about his story, about how this came about, that the victim grabbed the steering wheel. In the trial court, in the motion in limine, when he offered the testimony, all he said was, Mr. Muckerhide might testify that Braun grabbed the steering wheel. Nothing about what was happening when he grabbed it, if what he said, if he said anything. So it's really hard to compare, even if you take out the might, even if you say, he's going to testify Mr. Braun grabbed the steering wheel and that caused him to crash into the trailer.
Could I ask
how do you compare that fact with all the facts of the prior incident? I'm sorry.
Could I ask you about the character trait section of that statute?
You can. My understanding, and it's pretty limited, because I've never actually had a case, I don't think, that involved this part of 90404, it's where, except for the rape shield law, basically, evidence of a pertinent trait of character of the victim can come in. And my understanding is that pertinent character trait has to either be something that goes to an element of the offense or the defense or the state's case or the defense, or it's something, I recall seeing a case where there was a question about whether it was murder or suicide, and the victim's character, I assume meaning, you know, being depressed and maybe threatening suicide before all those kinds of things, was relevant. I don't see a pertinent character trait in the sense that that is used being at issue here. And, you know, to go back to the Young case, which isn't very satisfactory on most things, they do reject. In that case, Mr. Young wanted to get in chronic recklessness of Mr. Setzler, the passenger. And the court said, no, that's not really a character trait that's at issue in this case. So I just don't think it's what that section means by character trait. But I'm afraid I'm just not fluent enough in that statute to give a better explanation.
My hypothetical to Mr. Rosen, which I'll pose to you, you have seen Mr. Rosen, you've seen him talk, and he often talks with his hands. Is that simply not a character trait?
You know, I think probably it may not be a character trait under sub A, whatever a pertinent character trait is. I think if we were using it to show that he acted in conformity, that he did that and he did the same thing here, and we're trying to use it in some way to identify him, for example, it might be, because I think really when you look at 90404 sub 2, the way it's been used over the years, character has really come to mean propensity or disposition, good or bad, you know, usually negative, but it's not really character in the sense that, well, you know, he's honest or he's frugal or he's a spendthrift or whatever. If you look at some of the cases, and in particular in Sullivan, if you look at the little box that's used in Sullivan, which I think comes from Blinka, I think, you know, and especially, I think it's Blinka's treatise, too, that really says character really means disposition or propensity. Like, you know, and so I suppose anything that a person does, you know, I mean, it's hard to imagine, but I mean, suppose that we were trying to identify someone who had been in the courtroom from the back, and you didn't get to see his face, so you couldn't identify him easily, but, you know, I can tell you that when he was talking, he used his hands a lot. You know, we might or might not try to, you know, to characterize that in the 90404 box. So if you need character here, I think the character trait that the defendant was trying to use this for is that Braun was a nervous passenger or a controlling passenger. So I don't know, I mean, I didn't really make a separate argument that this should come out because he didn't tie it to a specific character. That might be an additional argument that could be made. I hadn't really fleshed it out.
It just seems to me, I'm driving along, and Your Honor, I was drunk. There's no question about it. And I had taken cocaine. But I was driving along. There was this accident when Justice Bradley grabbed the wheel. Now, it seems to me, if I made that argument to you, you would say, come on, give me a break here. This is just entirely too convenient to suddenly blame the victim. I don't think it's credible. But if, in fact, Justice Bradley has done that in the past to other people, they're willing to testify to that. There ought to be some way to get that into evidence. I mean, I understand that if I knew that she did that in the past, I could just make it up and say she grabbed the wheel. But on the other hand, maybe she did grab the wheel.
And I think that there is some attractiveness to that viewpoint, but I think what it hinges on is number of times and other people. Because to the extent that it makes it more likely she did it when you were driving, that certainly doesn't have much probative value if we only know that she did it with one other person who's related to her one time. And that really doesn't have much probative value. But the danger here, as Shadle explains, you know, there's prejudice to the state as well as the defendant when other acts evidence comes in that shouldn't. And one of the dangers here, I think, is that there's a real risk that the jury will put the blame on the victim in a general sense, or punish the victim, or say, well, he got what he deserved, or he should have known better from the prior incident, well, and not hold the defendant to proving all the elements of his affirmative defense.
Well, but you can do a curative instruction. I mean, state always says give a curative instruction and just say, hey, you can show it for identity, you can show it for character, you can show it for, but you can't use it to say that he did it in this instance. I mean, isn't that the curative instruction generally given?
It is generally given, but that's because in those other cases, it really is being used to show something else. Now, it also may have a tendency to show propensity, and that's why we tell the jury you can use it for this, but not that. Here, the only use of it is to show, to corroborate his story and make it more likely that the other person really did grab the steering wheel. So I don't know how you would, the only way I can think of that you would give a curative instruction would say, well, it has some probative value, but don't give it too much weight and don't let it get you too sidetracked from the real issues. It doesn't fit a curative instruction because you're not curing the real wrong. You're letting it in for the wrong purpose.
Let me ask about, I mentioned some of the treatises that I'd looked at, and this pull between whether or not other acts evidence has to be independent of or in addition to. Do you have an opinion on that?
I'm not sure. That's not clicking with me. I'm sorry. Independent of or in addition
that
to?
Other acts evidence is only admissible if it is offered for a purpose independent of propensity. It cannot rely on a propensity inference.
Oh, right.
And another argument is that it can be offered if it is in addition to the propensity inference. In addition to means give me your laundry list, and if you can pick out one of them, it's okay.
Yeah, I have not seen it phrased that way, the in addition part, so I'm not, certainly Wisconsin case law, and we cited Johnson in our brief and some other cases, make it very clear that it has to be independent of the propensity inference. And I don't know off the top of my head of any, our courts have ever discussed the alternative theory, if that's what it is, of in addition to. So I'm afraid I don't have anything very useful to say. I did just want to go,
do it very quickly.
Yes. Justice Prosser had asked whether the standards are exactly the same, whether state or the defense presents it. The Sullivan test is the same. You have all three prongs. In Shadle, you did say if you get to the point where you're looking at it for identity, in that case it was the defendant offering it to show another person did a prior crime and the crime he's charged with, we may not require as much similarity as we would with the state, but you still do the analysis. And in this case, I don't think that really, would make a difference here. And I did just want to also say there was a witness who saw the accident. He had already passed the defendant, so he saw it through his rearview mirror. But he definitely saw what happened, and in fact, he pulled over because when he saw the defendant coming so fast, he was sure he was going to hit the trailer. And so he pulled over, and then after he hit the trailer, he went back and offered assistance and called 911. So there is that witness there. I forget his name.
Thank you, Ms. Wellman. Mr. Rosen, you've got 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you. First of all, I do want to say that this isn't an expert case. We're not seeking an expert to come in to bolster my client's testimony. This isn't a rape shield case. This isn't a case where somebody recants. This is a case where we are simply saying, we're not looking at Scheidel where we're saying, well, make some bend the laws a little to let a defendant come in. I looked at Scheidel while Ms. Wellerman was arguing, and I saw that Scheidel basically had to do with the defendant wanting to present evidence of some unknown third party to corroborate that this he didn't do the crime in here. That's not what we have here. What we have here is a known third party where there is other acts evidence pertaining to that specific human being that goes for a legitimate purpose under the statute, which is relevant, which the judge said, the trial court said was relevant.
Well, if I could, Mr. Rosen, because I wanted to follow up where Ms. Wellman left off with you, and I want to follow up with Scheidel. And I'm looking at the general criterion, I think it's on page 301 of Scheidel, of when other wrongs evidence can come in, what are the requirements, and case cites to Fishnet, cites to Witte, says there has to be similarities between the other act and the offense for which the defendant is being tried. The threshold measure for similarity in the admission of other acts evidence with regard to identity is nearness of time, place, and circumstance of the other act to the crime alleged. Similarities which tend to identify a third party rather than the defendant as proponent also tend to ensure the probity of the other act's evidence. We apply the same standards, citing Oberlander. And then later on page 304 in paragraph 40, you don't have to have an imprint or signature, but you have to have similarities between the other act evidence and the charged crime. Now, you are attempting to offer other wrongs evidence to show that your client wasn't controlling of the vehicle at the time the accident occurred and didn't cause this accident. The passenger reached over and grabbed the vehicle and caused this accident. So I ask once again, using our criteria that have been established over the years, how similar do these acts have to be? How many acts, how similar in time, place? I mean, we're talking about different locations. We're talking a year apart. I mean, does this meet the Fishnick-Witte criteria for admissibility, or do you need something closer in time and closer in location? I don't know.
I don't know, Your Honor. I think it basically, but I think it's clear based upon prior, that one prior act, and I think under Gray, I looked at this preparation today, that there was a one prior conviction from 4 years previous to the act that was basically alleged. It was a four-year-old act that the court allowed to come in, basically, and they said, well, it's something about nearness of time. But the fact of the matter is, they said, well, there's an 18-month where the defendant was in prison. That still leaves 2.5 years, and the court allowed that to come in, the one act to come in. And I think what happens is when you start getting into, I don't think you have to start looking like maybe it was 15, 16, 18 years old as to where it all of a sudden ceases to become relevant, because I think clearly you have to look at the relevance issue. The court in this, neither the court nor the trial court of appeals nor the trial court looked at it as a relevance issue. They just looked at it as propensity evidence. This was one act, I think, that occurred 1 year before, and he had attempted to grab that wheel on 4 separate occasions, in addition to the one time he grabbed it within a year period, and that was of his own father. So I think that the issue becomes that it is sufficient in time. There was some sufficient similarity, which is clear under the case law that you cited, Your Honor. And the circumstance, the person was driving, Mr. Braun was driving when the victim grabbed, did it. We've got the same sort of situation here. I think when you look, and that's where Young once again comes in, where you've got, there are 4 times there, but if you're going to say 1 time as opposed to 4 times, I don't think there's a bright line threshold, but I think it clearly becomes where the state can then come in, well, you know, this is only 1 time, and, you know, therefore, they can argue that as part of credibility, but it's still relevant. And it still becomes relevant in terms of whether or not it's another act evidence. And it still comes in under Sullivan, I think. I mean, clearly for child sexual assault, you have a greater latitude standard and that sort of thing. And we're not talking about that here. But we're still talking about something that occurred within a year on one action where he actually was able to grab the wheel and another 4 times where he tried to grab the wheel. So I think you've got a number of instances where there was the attempt made and one was successful. And it's brought out what I think was most really, what I found really very credible about it, is that it was to be brought out through the victim's own father. It wasn't like Mr. Mukherjee brings a buddy in to say that, or his mother comes in, or his father comes in. The victim's own father is willing to come in and say this happened, which I think is another factor that goes to the issue of credibility, and it's why it becomes even more relevant. And I think that when you look at all of that, I think it becomes clear that it is something that's relevant. Young did distinguish between propensity. They did have an argument about propensity. And I see I'm out of time, if I could just
finish your sentence, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. Is that They did argue about propensity. They argued about where they rejected the issue of that the argument of habit. They rejected the defendant's argument about habit. They said it's propensity, evidence is not appropriate. But then they get into the specific other acts arguments, and that's where they come into the allowing it to come in as specifically to show that the identity of the person responsible for the accident was Mr. Setzer. That's their own words. And I think what's even more interesting, I think, and I appreciate Justice Bradley finding that New York case, because I was looking, it seems that the case law in Wisconsin is that if you've got a whole body of cases, all of a sudden you become to start having some sort of substantial judicial precedent. And that's the case, that's the words used in ER versus Flynn, which I cited in my brief. You've got cases, our view of these cases, is readily apparent reading the decision of these other cases, states that the statutes are almost a word-for-word repetition of our statute. Consequently, it is our view that these cases provide us with substantial judicial precedent. That's where you look at the other cases and the other states. So where you start having a track record of other cases coming forth and other states coming forth, various states, not just two cases out of Washington, but you got one case out of Washington, you got another case out of New York. All of a sudden you have a body of, quote, substantial judicial precedent.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Rosen, and thank you, Ms. Wellman, for another argument about other act or character evidence in a different framework. That concludes our hearing in 2005, AP 81-CR State of Wisconsin versus Merkaride. The court will meet in a closed session at 3:20, and we will be in open court at 9:45 tomorrow for continuing oral arguments. We are in recess.